I'm going to have a lot more to say about the special election selections. I'm going to have a lot more to say about that decrepit old Irish potato, Bud Friel. I'm going to be able to do anti-Irish slurs because we brought in an Irish priest to absolve me after this. So I can do whatever. I don't know what Episcopalians do, but we're going to find out because I'm going to do a lot of anti-Irish slurs against Bud Friel. Fucking Irish lurch. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. I'm Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Welcome to it. Hello. We're in the studio today with, as always, super producer Carl Stomberg. And our guest today is the rector of the Episcopal Church of Saints Andrew and Matthew in Wilmington, Reverend Patrick Burke. Reverend Burke, hello.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thank you. And whatever you need to do to absolve me later, I'm into it.
I'm always happy to hear your confession, my friend.
Let me tell you something. How long do you have?
I got all the time you need.
Our paths crossed recently based on some issues with the homeless population and the unhoused population outside of Sam and Friendship House. Our paths crossed a little bit earlier this year because I know a lot of the organizing that Network Delaware does, the Homes campaign especially, but other campaigns sort of work out of or in partnership with Sam. We use that space a lot. So I'd seen you sort of walking around. I'm glad we got to meet. And I usually start these with asking people like how they grew up and what it was like and how they found themselves in the current sort of advocacy role they're in. But you have a very specific story that sort of mirrors mine. And I will tell you that I went to a panel discussion about 2 weeks ago at the Westminster Presbyterian Church. You were on the panel. And when you were introducing yourself, you said, you know, you had spent like 15 years in the corporate world and then became a priest. And I did notice people in the audience sort of like, whoa, that's crazy. And obviously people know I came from the corporate world as well. So can you talk a little bit about that, what you did and how you found yourself sort of walking out on that and walking into something completely different?
Yeah, absolutely. So my original background, I was a trained musician. So I ended up in Indiana to study music performance, and circumstances dictated that I needed a real job. So I went and I worked for Progressive Auto Insurance for 17 years. And in the midst of that, I had left the church for a while, and my wife was probably about 6 months pregnant, and we looked at each other and said, hey, we probably ought to go back to church one of these days. And so it was a little Episcopal church down the road from us, and my wife had grown up Episcopalian. We'd gotten married in an Episcopal church. I'd grown up Roman Catholic, which is, I believe, our shared heritage. Yeah. So deeply meshed in Catholic social teaching, which I'm sure we'll touch on at some point, because it's certainly been an influence in my organizing and my advocacy work. But in the midst of getting back into the church, the Episcopal Church offered a lot of things that the Catholic Church did not. We were married by a woman, which was mind-blowing to me and kind of started to address several of the things that I had struggled with and why I'd walked away from the church. And then, we joined a church that was fairly progressive, but still suburban, and just opened my eyes to what church could actually be versus what I had grown up with and lived with. And so next thing I knew, we had no one to do youth ministry in our church, and we had just a lot of teenagers and young kids. And so I found myself building a youth program with no experience. But it was a lot of fun because it gave me a chance to explore faith with a bunch of teenagers. And next thing I knew, I was pretty disillusioned with working in corporate America. And Progressive is a good company, per se. But I saw what I was doing on a daily basis, and I'm going, man, I know people are having a rough time with, I'm just doing my job, and frankly, it's screwing a lot of people over. Yeah. I can't. There's something wrong here morally. And so the more and more I wrestled with that, and I, you know, I was middle management. I wouldn't light the world on fire, but I certainly was successful. And I kept thinking, what am I doing? Something's not right here. And every time I turned around, what was life-giving to me was taking these kids on mission trips, was working with them and helping them learn how to serve, sharing their stories with the rest of the congregation, which was engaging a lot of these, you know, not only their parents, but, you know, their grandparents' generation on activating their faith through serving others. And I just kept going deeper into that. And finally, my priest looked at me and says, you know why this is good for you, right? I was like, why? He's like, because you're called to be a priest, dude. That's why it's given you so much life. And so it was a long process after that, but that's how I got into being a priest. I was lucky enough to have a family that supported me and a seminary option that I could work while I was in school. It had its own challenges, but I was able to commute. I was living in Indianapolis at the time. I commuted to Chicago for school. And then when I was ordained to the priesthood, I quit my job at Progressive, and I've been doing this ever since. So that's the medium-length version of that story.
Yeah, I'm just, because I had a similar sort of experience, it really resonated with me because I wasn't an executive or anything, but I made a very good living. And you look at, and I was sort of back office, you know, it's like, you know, I worked on projects that like tweaked scorecards or implemented algorithms or did all of this stuff. And you're like, well, what does that actually do? And you start to think about what it actually does. And you're like, wow, that's pretty sick, actually. Yeah, so I think, I don't know if I told you, I remember the last place that I worked was Chase. And about 2 years before I got laid off, I remember telling somebody at lunch, like, this is going to be it for me. Like, the next time I'm laid off, which is like everybody's sort of ready for that. And I've been laid off multiple times in the past and just got another corporate job, same, that I'm not going to do it anymore. And I didn't. And that's sort of how the podcast started. I started when I was still working. And then we started sort of thinking about putting stuff online and doing the call around the time that I was laid off. And that's it. But yeah, I couldn't really stomach it anymore. You know, and the insurance business is now really in the news. Health insurance, anyway. Yeah, people are starting to figure it out. They're like, wait a minute. Is this what these people are doing? Yeah, actually, United Healthcare is using AI to like cut through claims. It has a huge sort of error rate, but the idea is that most people aren't sophisticated enough to appeal declines.
Yep.
And so, yeah. That's how it works. It's very strange.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough. This was almost 10 years ago now that I was wrestling with this. And at that point, the big move was centralization, right? So moving, most of our work was in the field when I started with the company. And they were slowly centralizing everything into call centers because there was huge real estate savings and huge people cost savings. And that was brutal because I'm sure it's a very similar experience watching your friends and your colleagues who you work with, you know, all of a sudden half the people in your pay grade are gone, right? And just laid off. And for what reason? Because their position's been moved to Cleveland or Austin or Colorado Springs. Those are the big places they were centralizing folks. And so we hadn't wrestled with the AI piece of it yet. That was new technology at the time. But I can only imagine how that's going to change that stuff. It's really, there's a huge moral conundrum just as you were talking about Mollusk, I mean, no one's wrestling with, or there is no moral compass in the world on how to wrestle with this stuff ethically, but it's a whole different conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot. So, like I said, thinking back on our coverage of the corporate, changes mm-hmm. that got pushed through last session, yeah, there really isn't any kind of ethical implication. It's like, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do it for the reasons that we already came up with.
Right.
And so there's really no questioning it. You just sort of blindly rubber stamp it and move on.
Right. And just an aside, although I suspect we'll touch on this as we go, you know, my position on the position of the church in this world now is the church should be one of those voices, a moral compass in those conversations. And we have abdicated that responsibility for far too long. So it's hard to be in that that scale of the discussion, but certainly that's one of the things that drives us at SAM with the work that we're going to be talking about, you know, with the unhoused population, those who are living in poverty, any number of different issues of what's right and what's just. When the church abdicates her position from those conversations, what are we doing anymore? What are we even here for if we're not going to be engaged in those conversations, if we're not going to be fighting for those who have little to no power, little to no voice? That's the place for the church. And how are we not involved in that conversation to raise the red flag and say, you know, whether it's the even the executive legislation around the ability for him to overrule the entire board or get paid whatever the heck he wants, like, where is the ethical red flag? Where is the moral authority in that conversation? And the church has been out of that conversation for too long.
Yeah, and if I feel like if organizations and communities that are built around morality don't step in and at least state their position on it, no one else is going to.
Absolutely.
You're not going to see the governor step in and be like, oh, you know what? It's probably the wrong thing to do.
Right.
Nobody's going to do that.
Right. No, and not to dig into the power dynamics too deeply, but it's like the church for too long has cozied up to power. You know, there have been individual places, individual clerics, individual churches that have not, but historically, the large church has cozied up to power. It's safe, you know, and we've benefited from that. But as I think one of the things that we're seeing is as congregations decline because the population is becoming more secularized, one of the things we have to wrestle with then is, well, how do we live into a world where we don't have that kind of secular power? That's actually a more faithful place. That's actually a more Jesus-centered place.
Yeah, I'm in a weird sort of position there too, because I think we talked about it briefly when we had lunch last month. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, grew up Catholic, went to Catholic school, mm-hmm. sort of fell out. I started reading Ehrman. Mm-hmm. And stuff about early Christian sects and early Christian scripture that, you know, wasn't included in the canon and why and mm-hmm. all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then I had a brief but very embarrassing internet atheism period. And obviously that we see where that has gone. And I was lucky enough to extricate myself. Because I did have, you know, times where I would be reading or watching or listening to someone mm-hmm. and thinking like, okay, well, this does not make any sense. I'm not going down this road. Mm-hmm. But I had already sort of like, not committed to it, but been like, oh, yeah, these guys know what they're talking about. They didn't. But I never, I'm struggling to not get back into it because I'm still an atheist, I guess I'll say. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Like I think that I want to do all of the things out of a feeling of like community mm-hmm. or, you know, consciousness, whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Not really of a belief in some sort of other framework. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I would look at it like.
Yeah.
So it's I'm in a sort of a strange spot like that. I don't know how. I mean, did you sort of? I know you sort of fell out, and you mm-hmm. sort of wanted to get back into the church when your children were born.
Yep.
Where were you? Where was your head at then? Were you always thinking about getting back, or did you think, "Nah, that's not for me. I'm not even going to go that direction."
So as you mentioned, you know, an internet atheist. I was like, "Yeah, that would describe me pretty well." I can remember sitting there at my computer in college. I was a first year graduate student, and just had a house by myself, a little one-bedroom bungalow, right? And sitting there reading stuff on the internet about the history of the Bible and the transmission of the text, and got into Ehrman and go, you know, going down very similar, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls were all the rage at the time, and try, and, you know, and so all of it was one of those pieces where I had no interest in going back to the church, and I don't know if I would have described myself as a theist or not. It didn't really matter. What mattered to me was, how do I live my life right? You know, how do I do the right things? And what drew me back to the church was actually community. As you're talking about that sense of doing, that's why mutual aid is so, I'm drawn to mutual aid organizations and that kind of work. It's like when we care for each other in community, that's love. That's what we should be doing. And the interesting thing is, I would argue, go to the beginning of the books of Acts of the Apostles, or Acts in the Protestant church, that's lived out by the original disciples of Jesus, right? But that's not, I see some of that lived out in groups that are way outside being, you know, Christians or even being people of faith per se. They're more humanist in their thrust, but they're living out what actually we see in Scripture from the early Jesus movement very deeply. So it's interesting you say that, because that resonates with my personal experience very deeply.
Yeah, and I came to this conclusion that, like, okay, you can sort of believe it's not true, mm-hmm. in a true yep. sense. But there's something going on, you know, when human beings gained consciousness. Yep. Like, not only are we here, we know we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that step, I think, has not been fully unpacked. So yeah. It makes sense to say, okay, I'm gonna give myself a framework to try to express that in some fashion, because it's sort of mysterious. I don't know. Yeah. Have you ever read The Origins of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind?
No.
So this philosopher from New England, Julian James, I think is his name, okay. or Janes. But through critiquing the literature of the Iliad and the Odyssey, I mm-hmm. think, was able to pick sort of scenes there that indicate that at that time, or that describe the idea of people realizing that the voice in their head is themselves. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're not getting an,
right.
like you can not talk, think. You hear yourself think. That's not like anybody talking to you. That's actually just you thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fascinating, and it's incredibly difficult to read. I've never really gotten through it, I don't think. But it really gave me a foundation for, okay, this is sort of where we're at now, and this is kind of what everything stems from, that moment or that time. It wasn't just yep. a moment, but yep. but yeah, it's just a framework to sort of express yourself.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because one of the things that this is a real deep dive into my consciousness, I'm fascinated by ancient human origins. And one of the reasons I'm fascinated by it is just the evolution of the human species is just, I think, incredibly miraculous. It's amazing. And it's amazing how little we know at the moment, but we keep expanding our understanding every year. And it's a fascinating piece of our history. But one of the things that's really fascinating to me is I always have felt this in my own spirit, and I feel when I talk to others too, that there's always some flicker of a connection to the divine. And one of the earliest things that we see in human culture is some sort of religious experience, right? Cave paintings, much of the you know, the their beads, their jewelry, these things that we have now that we found 10,000 years old, 50,000 years old, 100,000 years old, is focused on some sort of connection with what is out there that is bigger than what I am. And it's just interesting to me how we wrestle with that. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, the church is fascinating to me, because in some ways we try to foster that and try to help people wrestle with that. And in many ways we squash that in the name of institution at times. But that's as a person, as an individual priest, I find it fascinating to speak with folks and wrestle with, how do you understand, whether it's understanding it from that, you know, rational framework of, hey, look, these are the synapses in your own brain creating this narrative in your head, or is there some connection with some higher power? And where people fall on that spectrum and how they engage in that, I find is just fascinating and beautiful, because it's, there's something there that human beings just naturally want to wrestle with. We try to use language, but language is incomplete. you know, visual arts help with it, oral, you know, as a musician, certainly there are things that can be felt and experienced through music that, you know, words cannot comprehend. But just engaging in all those forms of discussion through philosophy, through religion, through prayer, that to me is something that keeps me really engaged in the work, because it's also the individual connection from person to person that makes it so powerful. Again, getting back to that idea of community, that's what's so powerful about all of this. So I love that question. I love that conversation. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Before we get to the news part of this,
yeah,
I do want to touch on the idea that, because I like this idea a lot, mm-hmm. and you mentioned that you're sort of, I don't want to say outgrown, but you weren't as happy as you could be in Indianapolis and Indiana, mm-hmm. and so you were looking to sort of move on, do something else, mm-hmm. and you sort of picked out this role because of its history and because of its location, mm-hmm. and its congregation.
Yeah,
can you talk a little bit about that and why you did that and how that happened?
Absolutely. So the Episcopal Church, the way priests find new jobs is a little different than some other traditions, like in the Roman Catholic Church, the bishop will appoint you to a different place, or in the Methodist tradition, they do that. In the Episcopal Church, as priests, we're kind of free agents. And so we apply to a church that has put out a call to hire somebody new, and it's sort of like a dating game, right? You put your profile out there, and do they like you or not, and that sort of thing. So I had been working in Indianapolis, a large church with a large staff, multiple priests on staff, and my role was very, very specific to being out in the community. So I worked as a chaplain with other organizations like Black Lives Matter and different mutual aid groups and any number of different groups like that, and trying to build relationships with them and see where the church could go to be in different types of ministry with groups that hadn't traditionally been involved with the church. That was the thrust of my role. And it was a wonderful role, but Indianapolis was starting to become problematic for us. So my wife and I are both from Connecticut, New York. We've been in the Midwest for almost 30 years. We really wanted to come home. Our daughter was getting ready to graduate high school. And, you know, politically, Indiana, just look what's happened in the last year since I left. I mean, they've got their new lieutenant governor is, in addition to being a pastor, is a conspiracy theorist and wants to remove vaccines from, you know, from use and all these other things. And it's like, we're kind of done with this area. So I was feeling that pull from a kind of a family personal perspective, but vocationally, you know, I was enjoying what I was doing, but I was part of a system that I was never going to change, right? I just didn't have that kind of role. And so I started exploring whether being the lead pastor would be what I was called to, though I swore I would never do it. And so almost immediately after kind of saying, okay, I think it's time to start looking, someone sent me the profile for SAM, for St. Andrew and Matthew here in Wilmington. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is like the church I've been dreaming of. You know, so for those who don't know the history of this particular parish, it's right in downtown Wilmington. It's been at 8th and Shipley since its inception, but its roots go back to St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, which was at that spot since 1829, historically white, wealthy, but very engaged in, you know, particularly housing, having a shelter on site. They've hosted the Friendship House Empowerment Center since its inception. They've had, you know, feeding ministries for generations, not just decades, but generations. And then that church consolidated with St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, was the only historically black parish in the area, Episcopal parish in the area. And they were down on Walnut Street, kind of between Bethel AME and the YMCA, where St. Michael's School and Nursery is. That used to be the home of St. Matthew's Episcopal Church. So historically black, historically white parishes consolidated in 1996 and have been racially integrated ever since. And their mission and their ministry has really been about justice. So all the things that I've been, you know, working on and engaging with around racial justice, around inclusion of the LGBTQ community, and not just, hey, you're welcome to come here, but you're fully integrated into the life and leadership of this parish, breaking socioeconomic barriers, all those things that I'm really, really passionate about. Because if the church is going to be who we claim to be, we reflect the whole of humanity. That's what we claim to be as a church. And this was a church that it felt like, at least certainly on first glance, but it's felt like that since I've been here too, a church that really wanted to do everything they could to live that out, as hard as that struggle is at times. So that's kind of what drew me there. Once I, in our tradition, you sort of go through an interesting interview process where you kind of interview on Zoom at the time, or, you know, sometimes over the phone, but interviewed via Zoom, got invited to come and be here in person. My wife and I visited for a few days about a year and a half ago now. And you could feel when you walk through that building, you both know that auditorium because I know you both spent a lot of time in there. It just feels like a union organizing hall. Right. It just feels like this is where the real work of democracy and justice and fighting for what's right takes place. And then finding out all the different groups that, as you said, not only meet there, but are fostered and supported in many, many ways by the congregation. For Episcopalians, a little bit different than Roman Catholics, but, you know, we're very attached to what we do on Sunday morning. How we worship together is a big deal. And many churches have a very narrow understanding of that. So in our tradition, which stems from the Church of England, very specific type of beautiful, you know, like choir music, and, you know, a lot of churches in our tradition have children's choirs and things like that. And here's a church that stems from two really diverse cultures coming together, and that lives on a Sunday morning. So we'll have African drumming in the same service as having, you know, an English or an Anglican chant for a psalm or something like that, you know, gospel music, soul, a big focus on the spiritual tradition. So the music really resonated with me. But then as I got to know the folks, I mean, we have folks. Was listening to a story on Sunday morning. We were folks who had gone on a racial justice pilgrimage to Selma, Montgomery over the summer. And one of the elders spoke up and said, you know, I was there when Bloody Sunday happened. I was a kid. I was on a bus with a bunch of freedom riders. We got attacked. You know, we got attacked by white vigilantes on the way home. Those stories are alive and well in that church. That's the kind of place it is. It's full of folks who are new to the issues of racial justice, but are desperate to learn more, worshiping and living and being in community with folks who have been living this their whole life, have been activists and advocates for their whole life. And it's just a beautiful kind of community like that. So there's probably more than you were looking for in its
death.
That's
exactly what I was looking for.
But that's the kind of thing that that really not only drew me there to work, but why I've fallen in love with the place and with the people, because it's just powerful. It really is. You can feel it just walking in the door.
That's a perfect segue, I think, to the current events topic at hand, whatever you want to say.
Yep.
For anybody who walks past Sam Church or goes to an event in the auditorium, we'll understand that Sam and Friendship House on that block is a safe haven.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's sort of inside the courtyard where there's a very old cemetery, whether it's around the back where the Friendship House is, where there used to be benches, whether it's around the side where there's an alcove that is sort of more or less protected from the elements. Mm-hmm. It's a safe haven for people who have no place to go.
Yep.
And so, I guess about a month and a half ago, you received a visit And so we need to recount this. We need to do a little bit of a TikTok, as they say in the journalism game. So that was your pretty much your first interaction with the Wilmington police, right?
Oh no, not at all.
Okay. So what have your interactions been with the Wilmington police leading up to what we'll call the bench incident?
Yeah, you know. Basically, my interactions with the police had been one-off issues. Either, you know, somebody was doing something that was illegal, and we couldn't have. So I'd had to call them, I think, twice to have somebody removed from the church. Unfortunately, which is you probably learn about me, calling the police is my last resort generally.
Yes, and just as another bunker rule, it's rule number 17. Unless you absolutely have to, do not call the police.
Yeah.
If you see something, generally don't say something. That's the best policy. That's the bunker policy. Yeah. So, yes.
Yeah. And just a little bit of background on my experience with that. You know, in 2020, many of us were engaged in uprisings all across the country. And we were in Indianapolis. And we, several colleagues and I, spent most of all that summer into the fall out on the streets, and our role was really providing chaplain services to organizers and to mutual aid organizations. We figured out a way to get different churches in the area to host the mutual aid organizations, so their medical supplies and their food and water and stuff could be kept safe. Because one of the things we initially ran into was mutual aid organizations setting up with medics, and you got your medic supplies, you got your water, all that basic stuff, and the cops come in and destroy they call it an encampment. It's a tent with place for somebody to get sunscreen or a bottle of water, or they got a cut and we bandage it up. And so my experience has been, we know the racial outcomes when it comes to policing as well. I teach those things in my work as a priest. It's not that all cops are bad. They're good cops, but the system has a lot of issues, and the system outcomes are very bad for particularly the community that we serve at SAM. So we're just recognizing that up front, and being honest about that, because I'm not going to call them. Because that's not their job. Their job is not to police homeless people. Well, at least it shouldn't be. But that's a different conversation. So a couple of my interactions had been either with folks getting harassed as they were, either around the church or on church property by police and having to go out and have a conversation, or, the couple of times when we had people who were doing either dealing on the property or were acting ways that were just... We couldn't support. Those were the interactions that I had, and they were as you would expect. I when I don't agree with what they're doing, I tell them, because if they're harassing somebody on the street, I can't sit idly by and let that happen. That I would not be doing my job as a priest if a beloved child of God is being harassed by someone in power and I say nothing. That's not what my job is. So those have been the interactions leading up to that, and they were all with individual officers, no one from command, nothing like that. So on the day, I think it was maybe October 23rd or something like that. It was sort of towards the end of October, before Halloween. We were sitting in our staff meeting, and this happens every Wednesday morning at 10 if you want to come by and see how the sausage is made. So we're sitting there in our staff meeting, and the volunteer sitting at the front desk, who's one of our beloved matriarchs, was at St. Matthew's as a child and has came over to the new SAM in 96. So she's been in this church for almost 80 years. And cops walk in the door and they start talking to her about removing benches. And she's like... trying to figure out what's going on, and I hear what's going on. So I step out of the meeting and I go talk to them, and they basically said, hey, we've gotten some community complaints. They were not forthcoming on the specificity of said complaints, but we've got some complaints about people who are doing stuff on these benches, and we've decided that the best thing that can be done is for the benches to be removed. We believe the church owns them, and we want your permission to take them. And I said, no. And then I went into maybe a little bit of a tirade about why that type of action is not helpful. Taking public benches, and come to find out those benches have been there for nearly 40 years, taking benches does nothing to stop crime. Taking benches harasses people. It means, and I had a parishioner who needed to sit on the bench to wait for the bus or wait to get into Friendship House the next day. I found her sitting on the wall because she had nowhere to sit now. It affects the community. It certainly affects our ability to care for people and to build community, but it does nothing to stop crime. And so I engaged in that conversation with the officer, and we, you know, we were in round about that. And I said, you know, but I don't know who owns those benches. So you're asking me for permission to give you permission to do something that I don't know that we own them. Because here we were, here's this woman who's been in the parish the whole time it's been in existence. She didn't know who owned them. Other people in the office, several of whom have been there as long as the parish has been around, nobody knew whose they were. I said, so I can't in good faith also tell you that I know whose they are. So I said, if we don't own them, I can't tell you not to take them or to take them. It's not my decision. I said, but we need to agree that you need to figure out who owns them. You figure out who owns them, come back, let's have the conversation. Because if there are, the answer is no. Those are community benches. We put them there for a reason. They're part of our ministry. You don't take them, but you got to figure out who owns them. I said, the second thing is I've had interactions with officers over the last year. I've asked multiple times to meet with command because I have concerns about the tactics that I see around the church. I have concerns about the tactics that I hear from those we serve every day, telling us what their experience is with the cops. I want to talk to command about this because we need to have a larger community conversation about what tactics you're using with those who are in and around our congregation, but everyone in the community. We need to have that conversation because I wasn't hearing that anywhere else. Okay. So the officers said, okay, we hear you. We'll make it happen. Okay. So they left. We went back to our staff meeting. Come to find out, they'd gone down to the Wilmington Empowerment Center, one of the Friendship House communities. And the short version is they threatened to shut them down. They said that they're getting, and they were more elaborate in terms of the community complaints they were receiving. But again, no specificity on who was making them, which is another point of discussion.
We'll put a pin in that too, because next week's guest is Kim Eppenheimer. So okay. we're gonna fill in some details, at least with that exchange and how Friendship House was dealt with on next week's episode.
So. Just in my conversations with the staff there, and certainly with Kim, you know, the cops, you know, called them a public nuisance and basically said, you know, the work that you're doing here is causing all of these problems out here. And they said the same thing to me. They were part of what they were upset about with me was, you know, for many months we were not removing people who were sleeping in our churchyard because. Sleeping is not illegal. Land is not something to be policed like that. So when people needed a place to stay, we let them stay. And the cops were very upset about that and were happy to tell me how that was contributing to some of the problems. But one of the things that we got, they touched on it with the discussion with Friendship House that I tried to dig in more deeply with them was the issue of the sidewalk. Because when we've had to have people trespassed, they walk them to the sidewalk and say, hey, they're on public land at this point. You can't say anything. That's fine. I just can't have them in the church at this point shooting up. But, you know, as long as they're out of here, we're good. But they were then coming back to us and to Friendship House complaining about behavior that was happening on the sidewalk. It sounds like generally after hours too. And trying to hold us accountable to behavior in a public space. And I said, I don't understand how both of these things can be true. You want us to be in control of what people do on public space when it suits you, but when it doesn't suit you, it's public space and we have no control over that. I said, which one is it? Because from our perspective, this is not tenable. We can't control what somebody does on a sidewalk. that's your job as the police, right? And that's where I think things got a little heated, because they didn't have an answer for that. And they still don't have an answer for that. Getting back to the folks on the side of the church, which we'll talk, I'm sure we'll talk about here in a second, but that same issue keeps coming up. And it came up in the lawsuit with the Friendship House was a plaintiff with, Food Not Bombs was a plaintiff with, where the Delaware Attorney General had to come out and say, these anti-loitering statutes are unconstitutional. But the part of the issue with that is, where is the line of what they can police? How are they going to police it? And what are the ramifications going to be? And unfortunately, that's one of the concerns, is there's just inconsistency from officer to officer, inconsistency from member of command to member of command of what the law is and how it's to be enforced. And the problem is that the people that are stuck in the vice of that are those who have no power. And that's why the church has to step in and say, we're calling attention to this, because these folks have no way to stop you from doing this, but we will. So that's where a lot of this stems from.
Yeah. So they came. They did come, I guess, the following day, and
the same day.
The same day.
So
okay, I didn't know what the time limit was when they left. And then they come back.
So my understanding, again, they were down at the other end of the building, but they have that conversation with Friendship House. They walk outside. My understanding from talking to a captain was it was his commanding officer that made the decision, but I've heard several different versions of what actually happened from different officers. They brought an imaged Wilmington PD pickup truck, cut the benches off. They walked back into Friendship House and asked them, do you want these? And offered to throw them into the hallway, which, if you've ever been down that basement, you put benches in that hallway, you can't do anything. And that's where they stage all their, you know, all their clothes that they're giving out all winter long. That's where they, you know, a lot of their, you know, storage happens, with all the different supplies, all the different ways that they help people. You clog up that hallway, the work there ceases. But let's put the benches there was their option. And they're like, we can't take them. So they took them away. They may be in a warehouse. We don't know. We've asked. We've gotten no response. So, but it was the same day, because in fact, I was, ironically enough, I got a text message about it while I was on a Zoom call with other clergy in the Housing Alliance, talking about trying to find housing solutions that religious faith communities can partner with and participate in. So I'm sitting there on a Zoom call meeting about housing, finding out that the benches had just been cut out and removed. So.
And I guess the next move was the following week.
Mm-hmm.
There were a group of people living on A Street,
mm-hmm.
Between Orange and Shipley. There was a tent and people's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they come out and issue a ticket for the tent,
mm-hmm.
which starts the clock at 24 hours. If it's not gone, they clear it.
Yep.
So a lot of us went down there the following morning,
mm-hmm.
To just see what was going on,
yep.
record some stuff, talk to people. The tent did come down, but I think it was saved in some fashion by the person mm-hmm. who owned it.
Yep.
I was able to cut a few videos to sort of express my position on it.
Mm-hmm.
As everybody knows who listens to this show, friend of show, Michael Kalmbach, the artist Michael Kalmbach,
mm-hmm.
had his walk-in studio basically sold out from under him,
mm-hmm.
moved, and then his organization sort of slotted into another nonprofit organization out near Ellesmere.
Mm-hmm.
His studio was on Shipley next to Planned Parenthood. So it's like 6th and Shipley, something like that.
It was about a block and a half away from us.
Yeah,
and we felt when Creative Vision Factory closed down, we felt it, because they were engaging that community every day, and we felt the shift in that, because folks had nowhere else to go.
Yeah, and yeah. I said this when the Hope Center opened, and it's not a knock against the idea of it. I was mm-hmm. nothing. I thought it was an incredible idea. I thought it should be duplicated up and down the state. But I could not allow the idea that they were able to, you know, put it on in the middle of a swamp outside the city. I know that Mayor Mike was probably licking his lips about that move. Yeah. We've had the same thing with clinics for addicts getting their medicine. Mm-hmm. People, you know, complaining about that. What this is it's a cleansing. It's a cleansing of what they now call West Center City, so that big luxury apartment towers can go up. Mm-hmm. So the neighborhood from, you know, whether you want to look at it from the aspect of Kalmbach and the Creative Vision Factory, whether you want to look at it from Sam's Courtyard, and whether you want to look at it from the Friendship House, yep, they're cleansing the neighborhood of human beings.
Yep,
that's what's happening.
Yep, and it's not lost on any of us that catty corner to that entrance on Orange Street, so 8th and Orange, which at one point it was noted by individuals from Downtown Visions and from the police that all of a sudden 8th and Orange was the epicenter of quote-unquote the homeless problem of Wilmington, which is mind-boggling because there are people there, but it's not the majority of the population by any means. But what has changed is that huge apartment complex that's going up right there on Orange Street on the other side of 8th Street. From a preacher's perspective, it's been interesting because we can watch this crane, and it's been a sermon illustration more than once on a Sunday morning, but you can watch it from the auditorium. And I had some comments when we did a candidate forum for the city council in October, November, you know, pointing at that crane, asking, you know, council candidates to speak very directly about what their plans were to address housing, because all I've seen, and I've been here a little over a year, I have not seen anything in terms of affordable housing going up in West Center City, in downtown. Reach Riverside is a different issue. But in terms of, it seems to me, this is an outsider's perspective, although I hear rumblings of it and all over the place, it seems to me that it's a pretty clear plan just to move people out. That's the goal. And thinking about this from what is right and what is just, but what does good community look like? Good community does not look like, beloved community does not look like ridding an area of people. That sounds more like genocide than anything else to me. As opposed to, if we are a beloved community, we care for each other. Maybe that's the mutual aid piece of me coming out, but it's like that makes no sense to me as someone who loves community. When they're pushing those folks out, they're not only our neighbors, they're with us all day, every day, most of the time. They're in our pews on Sunday morning. These are our siblings in Christ. And you mean to tell me that they're not welcome around the area of the church? They're not welcome in the neighborhood they've lived in, some of them for decades? Especially then you start to layer in all the other pieces of how landlords are not held to account and you know, the rising costs of rents and housing in general. All those systems are coming together to one point of inflection, and that is on the folks who are the most vulnerable in our society. And it says something really, really important about who we are as a people, who we are as a city, who we are as a community. Do we care for those who are most vulnerable? Or do we just think about how much money we're making?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think the city's position on that's been pretty clear. I don't know if you know this. You probably do, actually, because it happened within the last year. Mm-hmm. There is a sort of derelict home that was built on Pennsylvania Avenue, mm-hmm, up here by Tower Hill, next to the Devon.
Yep.
It has the arc, the famous, it looks, you know, it's like a mini Arc de Triomphe, and it has gardens there. It's called Gibraltar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it was built, I think, in the late 19th century, early 20th century by, you know, a well-to-do person, mm-hmm, fell into disrepair. The city has been trying to do different things, you know, have them make a bed and breakfast out of it, sell it to a private citizen, all of this stuff. They have not been able to do anything like that, and it's fallen into heavy disrepair. Okay. The people in there taking pictures. Well, come to find out, the city just decided, you know, we're just going to buy it. And, you know, that seems weird at first, but then you think, well, where does the mayor live? And then you look at a map, and you're like, oh, this derelict mansion, this run-down property, is the mayor's neighbor.
Huh.
That's something. You know, spending, what'd they spend on that? $900,000 or something, $800,000? I forget. But they wanted to make sure that, you know, the city now owns and can clean up and can do whatever they want. Because, yeah, it's literally borders the mayor's property in the Highlands. Yep. So that issue got solved somehow. Unbelievably, you know, what a surprise. Yep. But we have no resources, you know, to get people housed. We can build 4 or 5 luxury apartment buildings in the same neighborhood over the course of 3 years or 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. But that comes at an expense of, just like, as you said, cleansing the neighborhood of people that don't want it. Just so rich people can ignore it or not have to look at it. Because I can tell you, it's not the epicenter. As people know, it's in the world, so I'll just say it. There's an office building. I think they have a dialysis and some other sort of medical across from the Children's Museum on Pennsylvania Avenue. Or the Children's Theater, excuse me. From the Children's Theater on Pennsylvania Avenue. And it runs up against the 95 bridge, Pennsylvania Avenue turns into Delaware Avenue. A group of people live behind that building. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact. I walk by there pretty often. I try to, you know, help if I can. I know many people have done that. I've been with others who have done that. Mm-hmm. But it's not an epicenter. It's just that it's more hidden.
Right.
And so you can't see it driving on 95. You can't really see it from Delaware Avenue. So, you know, it's just like, well, that's fine. If you can see it, it's a problem.
Right.
And that should be very, very illustrative to people. People should understand what's happening.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is.
Yeah, and I think this is where I've got Kim's voice running in my head, because she in a really, really elegant way, she's an incredible leader. She's talked very eloquently about how the city is shrinking for those who are living in poverty. Specifically, those who are unhoused, but those who are living in poverty more generally, and as the city shrinks for where they can go, what does that do not only to their quality of life but to ours? And are we as a community committed to caring for each other, or is not seeing it fix the problem? And unfortunately, it does seem like not seeing it fixes the problem, and that's not the community that many of us want to live in, just flat out. I mean, and it's just interesting to me as an outsider coming in to the city, I see many of the things that I saw in a much larger city. Indianapolis is about 10 times the size, maybe even a little more, actually. Very, very similar issues on a larger scale, but the same understanding that if they're just not there, we've made things better, as opposed to saying, you know what, part of our commitment to each other as members of humanity is that we care for each other. And that's where, this is where whether you come at faith from a theistic perspective, is believing in God and all of that, or if you just come to conversations in that vein from the standpoint of, we owe it to each other to love each other well. I don't think you can be engaged in that space and not look at what's happening and go, this is not right. This is not right. You know? But also I hear this in conversations with politicians too, of, well, you know, that's the state's responsibility, or that service is the county's responsibility. I'm telling you, from on the ground, what happens is that there's no one taking responsibility. And there seems to be this mentality, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm just misreading this because I'm new, but there seems to be an understanding that we don't owe, as a civil government, the civilian government, the secular authorities, do not need to take care of these folks because faith communities and nonprofits will do that. And that's not a sustainable model either. Faith communities are always going to be engaged in that work. But I don't know if you noticed, most faith communities are shrinking. Society is becoming more secularized, which is, everyone has their own option of what to do. That's not, my point is not to say come to church. My point is to say that we as a community, though, I think we have an expectation of our secular government that we're going to care for each other. And so when politicians then raise their hands or wipe their hands of the situation and say, I can't, we're not going to do anything, we as a faith community are saying, no, that's not the society we choose to live in. The society that we choose to live in, we care for each other. We're building community by raising up the most vulnerable. We're not building community by the elite just getting richer.
Yeah, I think, number one, and I think you have it pretty much correct. There's a feeling that, look, we have these nonprofits and the religious communities. They're going to do it. It's not our responsibility. That's just a cop out. Just an excuse. Mm-hmm. What the religious communities and the nonprofits do at the best of times is show some humanity. Try to get somebody fed so they don't die of hunger.
Absolutely.
Try to get somebody medical attention so they don't die. Try to put somebody in a tent somewhere so they don't freeze to death.
Yep.
That's it. That's the bare minimum. So those are there as the bare minimum. The responsibility is everybody's. So that means the responsibility is the civic government. Mm-hmm. So anybody saying that it's somebody else's responsibility who's in government is wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't really care to discuss it. Like, this is just what we should be doing. Right. And so I just tell people, I'm like, if you're okay with how the cops are treating people in West Center, treating homeless people in West Center City, treating the poor in West Center City and across the city, you're a bad person. Reflect on that. Try to do better. Look in the mirror and say, have some self-reflection, say, why am I like this? And then come back to it. But I'm not going to pretend that you're just doing your best. You're not doing your best. You're not doing anything. Fuck off. I don't want to hear, like, I get that a lot. They're like, well, what are they supposed to do? There's no mechanism. There's no process. There's no money. Well, you're in charge of all that. Right. You're in charge of the fucking process, bro.
Right.
You're in charge of the money.
Right.
So,
right.
Fix it. And I hate to do this because I know you're here from a religious environment, and we all work sort of in a non-profit-y sort of setting, but that's not a great model.
Right.
That's a bad model.
Right.
This is happening because the people who are responsible have skirted their responsibility.
Right.
So now we have to have these things. Right. Half of these nonprofits, I don't even know what they do. I know the one in Dover, the Code Purple in Dover, is now, they might be going to prison over money they got from the opioid thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are shady. Some of them aren't. Some of them are very good.
Right.
It's
a whole different piece of the accountability. Like, what's the accountability when you offload that
because
social service structure?
Right. The civil government is accountable because we have to have elections for all of these people.
Right. Right.
They have the responsibility and they're accountable for it. And if they don't do it, they should go.
Right.
But they are able to frame this as, our hands are tied in some fashion.
Right.
Fake out.
And just take a quick aside, because this comes out of the Grants Pass case, the Supreme Court case, Grants Pass, Oregon, right? We see a similar dynamic here in Wilmington with one of the shelters. Faith organizations are not held to the same standards as secular organizations, nonprofits or government agencies around equity and diversity and all these things, because there are religious exemptions for this. And so there's also this piece of, when we offload this to faith communities, some faith communities don't have the same, we don't all agree on what it means to live out the life of the gospel, right? For some, excluding folks who are LGBTQ from their shelter is acceptable. If you're non-binary trying to go to certain shelters, you have no place because you do not conform to the gender duopoly, right? Not all of us agree with that. I'm just say plainly and clearly, many of us who are Christian would say that is absolutely an abomination of the gospel. But that is the reality of the way that faith communities operate and nonprofits operate in the country. We do not have the same oversight and accountability as civilian government. It's just a fact. And so it's not to say that we don't have a role to play. We have a critical role to play. I think one of the things we don't do enough of is to work on the narrative to help people understand that what they're seeing when folks are being pushed out of spaces, that how do we attack that mindset? Because my argument would be very similar to, hey, if you're thinking that that's appropriate, come, we got to go confess. Let's go to the confessional booth and let's talk. But I think we as a church and others that we're aligned with, we've got to be out in the public sphere talking about how that framework is morally bankrupt. Because the way we operate in society, as human beings, we internalize the narratives that we hear, right? And then we live them out in our daily life. So there's a sense of responsibility on those that have imposed this narrative that is morally acceptable. We've got to attack that narrative. We've got to raise up the level of consciousness that we are talking about fellow human beings. And many times we're talking about fellow human beings who have experienced trauma on the streets that none of us would ever want to. I don't want to wake up in the morning and find somebody sleeping next to me that's been dead for 2 days because they died of an overdose and nobody was there. Many of the folks that we serve have had that kind of experience. They've been unhoused for decades. We're only going to fix that by caring for them. We're not going to fix that by shipping them down to the next park and then to the next park and then to, you know, some place out in the middle of nowhere. And not to say that the Hope, again, I'm with you on the Hope Center. I think it's a beautiful model. I think it's fantastic. We need one in downtown. People shouldn't have to be shipped out 5 miles. They should be able to live where they live. I keep thinking one of the things that I want to get into the out of just kind of housing activists and really into the public sphere is really talking about a housing first model, looking at cities like Minneapolis and Houston, very different politically, but they've both been able to really address the root causes of homelessness by adopting a housing first model. And a housing first model does not work because faith communities or nonprofits are in there helping people who are currently homeless. Housing first models work because there is a commitment, particularly from the highest level of the administration in Wilmington to be the mayor's office. It would include the county, it'd probably include the state because of how small we are. But housing first model only works when the highest levels of the government make sure that every aspect of governmental life is focused on fixing that problem. So they force the departments to talk to each other. They force the funding streams to be there to support the programs. But a housing first model has been shown, cities in the United States, God knows if you look at Scandinavian countries like Finland, Denmark, these places have fixed homelessness. It's not easy, but it's doable. And that's, I think, a space where faith communities, as we lose our capacity to have hundreds of volunteers feed people on a Sunday morning, we've got capacity to go out into the world and paint a picture of beloved community. We would draw on our faith tradition to do that, but I think it's a shared vision of what life could be like that we have lived with for centuries. We want to see come forth. We can share that narrative and we can help shape public opinion to say, hey, these people, it's not just that their lives matter. Their lives make our lives better. We will all be mutually enriched by deeper community, by caring for each other more deeply. That's a really powerful piece that we can add to the equation that keeps us out of some of this other stuff that's not our lane. It was never supposed to be our lane.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I do want to sort of let you talk about a little about the open letter that was written that was signed by over 250 individuals and groups, clergy, academics, advocates, just regular citizens.
Yeah.
It did a lot of things. One of the things that I was struck by is the idea that the one reaction from the mayor's office was to sort of question the way in which some of the interactions were completed, which, again, is just a cop-out. Mm-hmm. They know exactly how it was done. But also the fact that that was the point of contention. Like, yeah, it's a point of contention because we don't want you, like, rolling up and throwing people's stuff in the garbage or mm-hmm. treating people like trash.
Right.
But really, we need you to take fucking responsibility for this since you're the civil government of this place.
Yep.
So it was really, I think that was really telling, actually, that was sort of the response is to distance themselves from any bad interaction, mm-hmm. but also never say like, yeah, we have to move, we have to cleanse the area. Right. you're questioning the methods of our cleansing,
right.
When that's not actually what we're
doing. No, in fact, and thank you for framing it that way, because if you read the letter, what's the first request that we have? The first request that we have is for a meeting. That's it. The first request is for Kim and I to be able to sit down with the mayor and the chief of staff and the chief of police and talk about not only the tactics, but to start the conversation about how we can work on housing. We're coming as a faith community and a nonprofit that we want to start the conversation of how we can collaborate together to work on this issue. Only after that do we talk about, hey, these tactics are not right, stop them, and hey, give us our benches back because you took them inappropriately. But the only thing they responded to was like, we've been saying all along, yeah, the benches are symptomatic of the bigger issue. The bigger issue is a housing issue. The bigger issue is how do we treat each other? How do we create a community that's inclusive and welcoming to all? But their focus does seem to be on the benches. I'm like, I've had enough people reach out to me and to the church offering to pay for the benches. We could put 50 benches up tomorrow with the money that has been offered. But those benches represent something in our community that's been there for 40 years. It's about calling attention to, whether you call it abuse of power, inappropriate tactics, or if it's just a mindset of, we just don't want people in our sight line. Until we address that, we could. Who cares if we replace the benches? So in terms of that, in terms of the letter itself, just to name again, being relatively new to the community, the number of people, and we've had more. I don't know. I've had 15, 20, 30 people since we sent it on Thursday. Try to get on the letter after the fact, which I'm happy to put them on there. It's already been sent, but if we need to send it again, publish it again, their names will be on it too. It's the diversity and the breadth of the folks that are part of it. I mean, because I think this is an issue that so many in our community are concerned about. So it's there's a lot of church folks, there's a lot of, you know, affiliated nonprofits, there's academics, there's activists, there's just folks who have heard about this and going, this isn't right. It's very clearly not right. So I was really, really proud of the community and how diverse that community was to come together and stand up for these folks.
Yeah. Patrick, thank you for coming in. I very much appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the time.
I think this probably will not be the last time we speak to each other. We haven't decided exactly how we're going to do it,
mm-hmm.
But we have some plans to even do more. Like I said, next week's episode will be with Kim,
mm-hmm.
and we'll get the Friendship House's sort of take on this whole issue. But we'll also mm-hmm. Talk about the Friendship House in general, mm-hmm. And also other work that Kim does on the Police Accountability Board, for example. Mm-hmm. She's also the chair of the Newcastle County Police Accountability Board. So she's doing it all.
She's doing some great work.
She's doing it
great
all.
Great work, yep.
But we're really... I'm from Wilmington, and it's funny, like you said, you're here. I'm a Wilmingtonian, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have a fucking stake in this, and I mm-hmm. I don't like it. And mm-hmm. I want people who are responsible for it to take responsibility for it.
Yep. Yep.
And that's just it. And if you don't want to, then I'm not going to be, I'm not going to take your excuses at face value and just give you a pass. You're not getting a pass. And that goes to Carney and Saron Cade. I don't know if you know the Carney's chief of staff, the Carney Rego. The Rego for Przycki for Carney is going to be this guy, Saron Cade. Okay. He's not a good dude. He's a clown, a corporate clown. He was the person who tried to, who was instrumental in trying to privatize pensioners' health care in Delaware. If you followed the Medicare Advantage story,
sure did.
That was his thing.
Yep.
We're gonna have an uphill fight, but I'm up for it.
Okay.
I'm definitely up for it.
Well, and just to put a plug out there, you know, because a lot of folks that are going to be listening are really interested in housing. They're really interested in getting engaged in this, which is fantastic. Some easy ways to get engaged. One, call your city councilor and call the mayor's office. Tell them that addressing housing is really, really critical, and to stop these police tactics. The other thing is, whether it's donating your time or your resources to Friendship House, Housing Alliance is doing some great work around educating individuals and the community about issues of housing, ranging all the way from homelessness to transitional housing to affordable housing, everything in between. So go to their website, sign up to be a housing advocate. You'll get regular emails from their team. You'll get good information about that. But there's some easy ways to start to get engaged that don't take a lot of time, but can really, really make a difference, because it doesn't take 250 people in Wilmington is a lot of people. 1,000 people would have changed the election and the mayoral race. So your voice matters, your vote matters in this city big time. So those are some easy ways to get engaged and help this work. But we're really, on behalf of the church, so all members of the community who have signed the letter, who have reached out, who have participated in forums on this issue and brought their concerns to us, just in every way that members of this community have supported our church, we are really, really grateful, very appreciative, but the work's not over. Until we achieve a beloved community where everyone's welcome, the work continues. But thank you on behalf of the church, the Episcopal Church of St. Andrew and Matthew, to all members of the community who have supported us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming in and sort of helping partner and spearhead this. I think it's a building. I don't know why. Maybe it just has to do with what's, you know, different series of events, but people do seem to be connecting to this mm-hmm. in some way. Like I said, I was really upset to see Creative Vision Factory get moved out.
Yeah.
People understood what was happening, but really couldn't do too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Sam's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So
nope.
Jump on board and we can make a better city for everybody.
Amen.
Well, we'll talk to you next week. It's not. It'll be more of the same, but that's just the way it's got to be. You can hit us up at patreon.com/thehighlandsbunker, X the Everything app at Highlands Bunker, Blue Sky, the Lib app. We're on there too. Keep following the story, because we're going to keep doing a lot about it. I think it's important. And if there's one mantra to keep in your mind, it is that left is best.